An inky black sky full of stars is one of the most breathtaking views on Earth. But for people all over the globe, the stars have dimmed because of artificial light. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll explore the night with Paul Bogard, author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, and Jack Troger of the Dark Sky Initiative. We'll talk about how our view of the night sky has changed, how artificial light affects human health, animal behavior, and, of course, our ability to see and study the stars. We'll also check in with the city of Grinnell, one of the first towns in Iowa to pass a light ordinance. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are still places in Iowa where you can look up at the night sky and get lost in the Milky Way, but those places are becoming more and more rare. And Iowa is a darker state than most. This hour, we'll explore the night and talk about how artificial light has changed our relationship with the sky. In just a few minutes, I'll talk with Paul Bogard, who's author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. I'll also talk with a retired teacher and stargazer in Ames, also the proprietor of the website darkskyinitiative.org. Jack Troger will be here. We're going to start the hour in the city of Grinnell, because there are people and communities in Iowa trying to do something about light pollution. The city of Grinnell was one of the first communities in Iowa to pass a light ordinance back in 2006. Byron Heffley-Worley is a member of the Grinnell City Council. Hello, Byron.
Hello, Charity. How are you today?
I'm all right. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I love this show.
Oh, that's great to hear. Now, tell me what brought the idea to the city council in Grinnell back in 2006?
Well, it came up when two local astronomers, Professor Bob Cadmus at the college who runs their observatory, and a very avid amateur astronomer, Dr. J.R. Paulson, brought the idea to me and wanted to know if we could do something about light pollution so that their telescopes would still be able to pick up good views of the heavens. I brought that to the council. We discussed it over a period of a couple of months, and then finally put it together as an ordinance using the International Dark Skies Association Model Ordinance.
And were they having trouble? Did they have observatories on campus, or were there things that had changed recently that were causing them to be concerned at that point?
Well, throughout the country, we're having much more uplighting, that is, lighting reflected or directed up from our streets, our public areas, parking lots, and things like that. They were having a bit more trouble simply because the town is growing. Both of their observatories are out on the edge of town. But they were having a bit more trouble, and they really wanted to cut this off before they had a lot of trouble. It's the best time to fix a problem is before it gets really bad. It's easier not to have to go back and fix it at a later time.
So what does the ordinance say?
Wow. Well, when they brought the idea to us, we were first looking at the uplight problem, and we looked at the International Dark Skies Association model. And it goes into a lot of other things. It talks about, a good neighbor policy so that you don't have glare, you don't have overlighting, you don't have light trespass, say where your backdoor light with a motion sensor clicks on 20 times at night and glares into the neighbor's window. And we looked at the whole range of things that they were talking about and realized each one of these makes very good, clear sense. So we basically took that and put it all into our ordinance. So we talk about light fixtures and requirements for all public lighting. We talk about house lighting. We talk about security lighting. We prohibit things like advertising lasers and things like that shined up in the sky. So we really cover quite a broad range of things.
Right, right. And were there people who were concerned about safety? Because as much as we love to look up at the night sky, people also need to be able to see what's going on around them at night.
Sure. We did have some questions. People were concerned that we'd be cutting back on lighting, especially security lighting in commercial areas. And the real questions we got were, are you going to make us go in and change all of the lights that we have now? And of course, with the Constitution's ban on ex post facto laws, all of that stuff is grandfathered in.
So most of the concerns were economic, not security-based?
Yeah, and there really weren't that many. I mean, there were just questions. We had almost no pushback at all. People would read the ordinance or read the proposed ordinance, and everything made sense. And I said, yeah, we can all live with that. And oddly enough, we expected a lot more problem after it was enacted as an ordinance. We expected to have some real difficulties. And in 8 years, we've had no problem at all. Everybody who's been doing a development or working on lighting has read the ordinance. They say, oh, that makes sense. And then they go along with it. And in fact, we're finding that the Dark Sky Coalition, there are a number of organizations working on this project, they've had so much of an impact on the industry that really best practices in the industry follow what we wrote as an ordinance 8 years ago because it all makes sense. We're having very little trouble with it.
Can you tell the difference if you're, let's say, walking in another downtown versus walking in downtown Grinnell? Can you see a difference?
Yes, I can. I, a couple of weeks ago, spent some time in a similar-sized city in Michigan, and I could see a few points of light up in the sky. And I'm pretty sure they were stars, but, you really couldn't tell much. Here in Grinnell, we had the Perseid meteor shower the other night, and I sat out on my front porch and watched meteors for a while. I mean, you can really see the sky, and more importantly than that, since the lighting now has really gotten to the point where the professionals are pretty much working with this standard, I can also walk through town and not have glaring security lights beaming from a half a block away to distract me. It makes for a much calmer, less intrusive lighting system in the town, but yet all the street corners are well illuminated, and it's not a problem at all.
Since a lot of the questions that you did have when you passed this ordinance were economic, I wonder, are there economic benefits? Is this more energy efficient for people who are putting in outdoor lighting?
Well, sure. The analogy I like is back several hundred years ago, people figured out that if you put a candle in a wall sconce, you can see, but if you put a shiny piece of metal behind it to reflect the light out into the room, you can see better. You don't need as many candles. This is the same thing. If you put a reflector above your street light, above your parking lot lights, it directs the light down, you use less power, and you get a much better light pattern on the ground. So it cuts the cost. It can cut maintenance. Alliant Energy is currently on a project to replace all of our streetlights with LEDs, which last longer and cost only a fraction of what a modern streetlight costs. So I think the economic benefits are tremendous. It costs a lot of money to run outdoor lighting, especially. As an example, Grinnell spends last year, we spent about $55,000 just to light our residential streets. If we can cut that by even a fraction, that's taxpayer money saved with the same or better quality of lighting still in the streets.
Do you have other communities coming to you and asking questions about this?
Yeah, the city staff has fielded a number of questions. A funny thing about small towns is when you're writing an ordinance, plagiarism isn't a sin. It's really an art form. If you're going to write an ordinance, you bring in copies of ordinances from other similar-sized cities with similar situations, and you copy everything you can and then pick out the parts that are really applicable to your town. So I think people are using our ordinance, and I know they're using some of the model ordinances that are available online.
Well, Byron, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I love this show. I appreciate being on it.
Byron Heffley-Worley is a member of the Grinnell City Council, one of the first towns in Iowa to pass a light ordinance back in 2006. And this hour, we're talking about artificial light and how it's changed our view of the sky, how it's changed our relationship with the heavens, in fact. And we are trying to connect with Stargazer and the creator of the website darkskyinitiative.org in Ames, Jack Troger. We're having a little trouble. We suspect his phone might be off the hook. So, Jack, if you're listening, check out that line. And with me right now is Paul Bogart. He's author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Thank you for being here today.
It's great to be here.
Can you tell me what you saw that started you on the path to exploring artificial light and light pollution. What were the changes that you experienced in your life that made you think, I need to know more about this?
Well, the first thing I saw was the stars over the lake in northern Minnesota, where my family has had a cabin all my life. And so I grew up standing at the end of the dock under the Milky Way, and I got to know what a real night sky looks like. And I always say that I think that imprinted on me, and I've never forgotten that. And after college, when I finally got around to starting to learn the constellations, I very quickly learned that because of light pollution, we've lost a lot of the night sky that we ought to be able to see. And from there, I began to learn about how important darkness is, not only for the night sky, but for the health of our bodies, our souls, our spirits, and for the natural world. So it was really just this realization of what we're losing because of light pollution and how important darkness is for life on Earth.
Did you actually see a change in the night sky you were looking at? Were there constellations you could see as a kid that you couldn't see as an adult?
Yeah, there's a real sense that, you know, when I was younger, the sky was more brilliant, and it's just been washed out a little bit. And then on the edges, you know, on the horizons, you can see the glow from surrounding towns. And I think that, you know, that points to one of the problems we have with light at night, which is that the growth of artificial light at night in the sky is actually pretty rapid, you know, just over the last few decades, but it's just slow enough that we don't really notice. It's hard to notice. You know, the sky doesn't look dramatically different from one year to the next, but it's just a little bit more washed out.
Now, of course, when electricity came to cities all over the United States, towns all over the United States, and finally to rural areas all over the United States, it was pretty exciting for people to be able to light up the night. It extended their productivity. It extended their leisure time. It made them feel a lot safer. Do you think that culture, that excitement about lighting up the night, has just continued and led to this?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we love light. And I don't think anybody, I certainly am not saying let's not have light. And no one I talk to for my book said, you know, we shouldn't have light at night. I think everybody recognizes that we're going to have artificial light at night. The difference is, let's be aware of how we use it, and let's use it responsibly, intelligently, thoughtfully. You heard your earlier guest talk about good neighbor lighting. You know, so much of the light that we use at night is wasted. It just goes up into the sky or shines into our eyes or into our neighbors' bedrooms, and that doesn't make anybody any safer. So I think it's really just, let's have light. Light is good. Light can be beautiful at night, but let's use it thoughtfully and responsibly.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Paul Bogard, author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Wrapped up like a douche, another owner in the night.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the night sky. In fact, we're talking specifically about how we can't see the night sky as well as we used to be able to. We're talking about artificial light and how it's changed our relationship with the sky. With me right now is Paul Bogard. He's author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. He also teaches creative nonfiction at James Madison University in Virginia. And Paul, for this book, you did a great deal of research all over the world. Can you give us a little bit of a perspective on how the United States compares with other places in the world as far as too much light pollution goes?
Sure. Well, the U.S. Is the main cities in the U.S. are like the main cities all over the world. So whether you go to Europe, as I did, and spend a lot of time there, or the main cities in Asia or Australia or really anywhere, you're going to find light pollution, really bright cities. What the U.S. doesn't have anymore, unfortunately, are great expanses of naturally dark areas. We do have dark areas, and I found some great places, but when I first started researching the book, I called the National Park Service's night sky team, and I said, where can I go in the States to find a level one darkness that is a natural night sky with no artificial light? And my friend there laughed and said, Australia would be a great place to go in the middle of the continent there. So we don't have like the Sahara or the outback of Australia or the Amazon, where you just have that natural darkness left. But we do have some great places, especially in the national parks in the west part of the country, that are still pretty dark.
Well, you mentioned the United States. Are you just talking about the lower 48? Because I could imagine that in Alaska, for example, there might be some very dark places.
Absolutely. It's a good point. And Hawaii actually is one of the best places to see a phenomenal night sky as well.
You went to a number of different cities to look at the ways that they use light. Now, you started in Las Vegas, where, of course, there's a great deal of light pollution, and that's really the point. But you also traveled to other places in the world. You went to London. You went to Paris, the city of lights, and you had some fascinating conversations about lighting in Paris, because they've gone through a real evolution, not just to use lighting to enhance their city, but also to use light responsibly. What have they done there?
Well, they've done an amazing amount. And Paris, the city of light, is, you know, people think it's because of the just being bright, but it's really, they really think about the way they're using light. And they've spent the last 30 years relighting the city to create this beautiful nocturnal atmosphere that tourists from all over the world come to see. And I think that that's one of the emphases for me in the book, is just how beautiful night is and how beautiful lighting at night can be. We ought to be thinking about how to appreciate the beauty of night. But what Paris has been doing lately is to not only use light to make their city beautiful, but do that at the and to lower their energy costs at the same time. So the new lighting plan in Paris, for example, I talked with the designer there, and he was kind of laughing to say, you know, I have to keep the city as beautiful as everybody expects it to be, but I also am charged with cutting the energy consumption by 30%. And so what they're trying to do there, one of the things they've done, which I thought was, you know, fantastic, was to research where are people actually in Paris at night and at what times, because Paris, like every city in the world, essentially is lit at one level all night long, whether there are people out or not. And that is really a waste of energy. If we could figure out where people really are, where we really need the light, then we could actually lower the light in the places where nobody is in the middle of the night.
Well, and you also talk about going to New York City, and when you get to Times Square, it's like a cloudy day, but it doesn't actually feel like night when you're in amongst all of those artificial lights.
No, it really doesn't. I think that was, you know, one of the things I remember, the moments I remember most was being in Times Square at night and looking up and not seeing anything. I describe it as, it didn't even look like a night sky. It just looked like a domed stadium, essentially, because of all the light there. And I guess I would say, you know, we mentioned Las Vegas, we mentioned Times Square, and those are certainly the extremes, places that are really bright, and they're going to be really bright. But there are a lot of places, like your earlier guest talking about Grinnell, where we still have too much light. We don't need all the light that we're using there, and there's really no reason for us to have that much light in these places.
Well, and there is also a law of diminishing returns. You have a wonderful illustration in the book where people have those security lights outside their homes that either they leave on or they pop on if there's movement, that really, you know, are incredibly bright. And you demonstrate that lights like that can actually blind us. And if they're shielded, if they're controlled, we actually can see more.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons I'm optimistic about this issue is I think that when you point out things like this to folks, people pretty quickly understand what you're talking about, and they think, yeah, that doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense to have really bright lights shining into my eye at night. That's not going to make me safer. And I think the two images in the book that you might be referring to that really illustrate this. In the first shot, there's a very bright, you know, security light that we would all recognize. And then in the next shot, it's the exact same scene. The only difference is that the photographer is holding his hand up to shield that light. And when he does that, you can see the bad guy standing in the fence behind that light that you couldn't see when you didn't have that light shielded. And so what we mean by shielded is just to make sure the light is shining only downward where we need it and not into our eyes or into the sky or into our neighbor's bedrooms, where it's not really helping us at all.
Now, we've talked about how this artificial light has changed our ability to see the stars, and we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We also want to hear from you. Where are your favorite places to go to see the stars in Iowa or elsewhere? You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. But you also have researched some other very real ways that this artificial light has changed our world. And one of those ways is the effect that it has on animal behavior. What did you find out?
Well, it has a huge effect. And I, you know, this is one of the main motivators for me with the book is to talk about the nocturnal environment. We have 60% of invertebrates, so essentially insects, and 30% of vertebrate species are purely nocturnal, and so many other species are crepuscular. They're mostly active at dawn and dusk. And what has happened when we have developed artificial light and when we flood their habitat with this artificial light is essentially that we destroy the habitat, and it impacts their migration, their mating, their feeding. All these things, they depend on darkness for their living. If folks have heard about this, they've probably maybe heard about the sea turtles in Florida that come onto shore to lay their eggs, or the more than 400 species of birds that migrate at night in North America. But really, you know, when you think about life on Earth evolved with bright days, and we certainly need light, but it also evolved with dark nights, and we really need darkness for the health of our ecosystems.
Well, and humans, of course, are diurnal species, and artificial light has changed how a lot of us live.
And for the better. I mean, we all benefit from light at night. There's no doubt about it. I know I certainly do. But the challenge is that, again, our bodies have never evolved to be in artificial light through the night. And so the World Health Organization, for example, now classifies working the night shift as a probable carcinogen. It's just not good for our bodies. And what they're finding is that too much artificial light at night is disrupting our sleep. It's confusing our circadian rhythms, those internal rhythms that keep our bodies healthy. And maybe most troubling, it's impeding the production of the hormone melatonin, which is only produced in the dark. And lack of melatonin in the bloodstream now is linked to an increased risk for breast and prostate cancer. So these having too much light at night, being exposed to light at night is just really not good for our bodies.
Well, and you also point out that if these things are true, these negative effects of artificial light and working the night shift disproportionately affect a certain population in the United States, because people on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder are far more likely to have those jobs and work at night, right?
Yeah, that's really true. It's what's called an environmental justice issue at this point. But, you know, more and more of us are working at night. It's becoming, you know, as folks know, a 24/7 society. And we're asking people to, a lot of times for our convenience, be up at night and being exposed to these lights.
I want to bring Jack Troger into the conversation. He's a retired teacher in Ames. He's also been a crusader for dark skies for a long time. He's the proprietor of the website darkskyinitiative.org. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
When did you become engaged in this topic, Jack? What was it that made you start thinking about it?
Well, when I was teaching earth science here in Ames in high school, I immediately became involved because I'm also a lifelong amateur astronomer, and I've never been in under truly dark night skies, so I've always had to do my astronomy from less than perfect dark night skies. So I got involved mostly because my students pestered me until I got involved, because I taught a lot of very involved astronomy to my students, a very famous person donated 30 telescopes to our high school to allow the students to take the telescopes home and observe. And, of course, that immediately set things off. So I kind of hoped it would, and that led to the creation of a lighting ordinance here in Ames back in 1997, but unlike Grinnell's experience, Ames has only gotten much, much worse.
Really?
Lighting ordinances work up to a point, but the problem is with lighting ordinances, and I don't mean to be contrary, but I'm going to be the skeptic today. I'm going to play the skeptic's role. Lighting ordinances are great for what they do, but our society is set up in such a way that adding more light is what it's really all about. You're never allowed to have enough light. Like, tonight, that's enough. Let's not have any more. In that case, lighting ordinances might work, but the reality is that more light is added every night across the entire planet. And the more light that is added, whether it's shielded properly or not, contributes to more and more light pollution. More light equals more light pollution. So what we really have to do is not turn lights off, but to do something different than building lighting ordinances that don't really solve the problem. The problem has to be solved by working with trying to create what I call more creative ways of dealing with light at night. And in Paul's book, he mentions a group, a collective of designers, artists, very creative people in San Francisco called the Civil Twilight Collective. And they created for a design project what they call the Lunar Resonant Streetlights. In other words, creating streetlights, street lighting that reacts to the phase of the moon, whether the moon is even visible or not because of clouds, or any other thing that would force the streetlights to brighten or dim depending on how much light was needed. And we can do that now with the technology we have, using LEDs and various other types of technology that we already have. We don't have to invent anything new. We already, and in fact, and this is really what the essence of what my efforts are all about, is to try to create a system of lighting, not just street lighting, but all lighting that's based on what I call NLO, Nature's Lighting Ordinance. In short, I call it a moonlight revolution, and that is based on the concept that most, but not all, outdoor lighting should mimic, mime, and mirror both the color and the brightness of the full moon, because the full moon is a nighttime light that every human on Earth has lived with and has adapted to over thousands of years. I mean, it's a light we all recognize. Many people, I'm sure, in the audience this morning had an opportunity to see the supermoon just recently, a few nights ago. And I ask people, you know, go out during a full moon, if it's visible, and take a book out and see how much you can read. I read a page of Paul's book under the full moon, less than full moon, just the other night. And the full moon generates a huge amount of light. And though we can't at this point in our society live by that light alone, we can create light that mimics the full moon.
Interesting.
And well, as a result, save the night sky.
And, you know, it's an interesting question. Of course, the moon is up very high. And, Paul, when you talk about how we could light our night in your book, you point out that a lot of our lights are just too high, that we could actually install our lighting at a much lower level. Explain what the benefits of that would be and how it would work.
Well, I think that gets back to the idea that, you know, if you have a light shining into your eye, if you're looking up at a bulb you can see the bulb, it's not good lighting. It's making it harder for you to see. So if you lower that light and you're just lighting the ground, your eye can see, but you're not being blinded by the light. And I think that what we're really talking about here is the way that we think about light and darkness at night. And I think we need to start to help people be more creative and understanding about how we're using light, how we're thinking about darkness. We really have the technology now to do things a little bit differently. LEDs are going to offer us an opportunity. But if we don't change this idea that we were talking about here, that more light is always better, we're just not going to solve that problem.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guests are Paul Bogard, author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, and Jack Troger, who is a retired teacher in Ames. He's been campaigning for dark skies for a long time. He is the proprietor of the website darkskyinitiative.org. We'll also get to your calls in just a moment. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about darkness. We're talking about artificial light and how it's changed our environment, how it's changed our view of the night sky, our ability to study the heavens, and also our relationship with night and with darkness. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear about your favorite places to see the stars and also why you feel it's important to be able to see the stars. With me this hour is Paul Bogard, he's author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, and Jack Troger, who's the proprietor of the website darkskyinitiative.org. He lives in Ames. And Lisa is on the line in Davenport. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I love the topic. It's so important, and I'm learning a lot. My family was on vacation this summer to Canada, Quebec, and the Bay of Fundy, and I saw on the map or in some literature what was called a dark sky reserve. I was wondering what that's all about.
All right. Paul, is that something you can talk about?
Sure. A dark sky reserve. There are a number of different iterations of this by different organizations. The one that a lot of people talk about is from the darksky.org. Dark sky reserves essentially are places where we're trying to call attention to this value of darkness by protecting officially these dark areas. And typically, you know, if we don't protect these areas, they eventually will be lost. Even though you talk about Quebec, you talk about the Bay of Fundy, it seems like a place that's far away, but eventually light will get there unless we can call attention to the value of these places and their darkness.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for that question. And Paul, you actually write about the fact that there have been people in the Arctic who have reported that the sky has changed there. So that's a place where you would expect to have no light pollution whatsoever, right?
Yeah, it's true. A friend of mine who has worked in the Arctic has been told by the folks there that they're actually seeing changes in the sky there. We just wouldn't imagine it. But when you look at, and folks can do this online pretty easily, when you look at the photographs of the Earth at night, you see how there's light everywhere, and it's as Jack said, it's growing all the time.
I want to go next to Conrad Kramer, who is on the line from Coon Rapids. He is the executive director of the White Rock Conservancy. Hi, Conrad.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, great. Thank you so much for calling in. And I know that the White Rock Conservancy is a great place to see the stars. That's something that you bring a lot of people out to do, right?
Yeah, I mean, if people want to be reminded what a dark sky, you know, really is like, and not too far from the city, we do have some wonderful dark skies out here, and in Coon Rapids, we believe there are some of the darkest skies in Iowa, and in fact, the Ames Amateur Astronomy Club comes out here every year for a 4-day, you know, camp out, and you know, they come out here and do their thing and watch the stars. And on Friday night, August the 22nd, they open up to the public, and all these wonderful amateur astronomers with their, you know, really expensive and wonderful telescopes are all out there and you know, encourage people to come up and look through their telescopes and see what they can see and teach about the dark sky. And it's just wonderful. I mean, for the first time in my life last year, someone was able to point out the Andromeda Galaxy to me. And, yeah, it was just a smudge up there in the sky, the faint as faint can be. But you know, that is pretty impressive to be able to look out and see that from Iowa. So I would just encourage people to come out and join us on the 22nd if they'd like to see the dark sky. And, you know, for me personally, I really regret that so many people, you know, live in such bright areas, or especially kids that grow up in the city, because, you know, if you grow up and you can never look out and see the Milky Way, and in fact, never look out and can see the galaxy, I think our tendency is to think that our problems are everything, and that you know, everything is really about us and about our cities and our problems. But if you grow up someplace where you can see the galaxy out there, there's no way you can grow up thinking that way. And I think it gives us a much more a healthy perspective on who we are and our place in the universe.
Well, Conrad, thank you so much for calling. And again, so that's Friday night, August 22nd, if people want to be a part of that.
Yeah, 7:30, and they can get information on our website at whiterockconservancy.org.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. And that brings me to the question. I mean, Conrad answered beautifully for him why he feels it's important for us to be able to see the stars and experience the night sky. Jack, why do you think it's important?
I think it's important because all of the universe is part of who we are, and we are part of the universe. And I've been fortunate in my life that I grew up in Mason City, northern Iowa, and I became interested in stargazing early on. And I have spent my entire life doing it and teaching it. And I can't even begin to describe to people or express the feelings that I've lived with all my life. And as I get old now, my eyesight is fading, and I can't see the night sky anymore. So it's difficult for me, but on the other hand, I want to use my knowledge of the night sky to try to help people to realize that just how important it really is, not just to people like me, but to them. And to get out underneath the night sky and enjoy it and not be fearful of the dark. It's an irrational fear that we are taught. We are taught to fear the dark. It, you know, think about all the movies I saw as a kid growing up, horror movies in the 50s. I'm not afraid of the dark. And I would encourage people to try to think of ways to eliminate the lights that desecrate nights. That's my slogan.
And Jack, you know, as a teacher, you had access to a lot of tools to introduce your students to the night sky, and there are even more now. The videos that you can show, the planetariums you can visit, the books with the, you know, amazing images from the Hubble Space Telescope, and mm-hmm. you know, all kinds of things. I mean, we've had these rovers on Mars. We can see so many things.
Yes.
But why is it important to look through a telescope? That image isn't going to be like the one in a book. But what is it about seeing it with your eye that makes the experience so profound?
It's very personal. I rarely express personal things publicly. To me, it is the photons of light, the light that comes from those distant objects in the universe, coming through the telescope and into my eye. They come to my eye. It's a very personal expression of being able to see the universe. I know that isn't... it's just very personal with me. I don't know how to express it to other people. I've tried and tried and tried in my writing and in my teaching, too. I had the same difficulty with when my kids would say, well, what's it like? What's it like? And I said, you just have to go out and do it. You just have to get out underneath the sky, whether there's light or not, and just enjoy the universe. It's just very hard to express.
Well, and Paul, you write about the same thing. You talk about seeing Saturn through a telescope and how it just stunned you to see Saturn. And, of course, you'd seen images of Saturn. You knew what Saturn was supposed to look like. But here you were looking at Saturn through a telescope, and you could see the rings. Why do you think that was so powerful for you?
Yeah, there is something about seeing it with your own eye that is really powerful. I think it's like going to a place that you've heard about all your life, you've read about, and just to actually be there feels a little bit different. And, you know, I'm really moved by hearing Jack's story and hearing about him losing his sight. I'm reminded of one of the stories that I tell in the book is a guy named Ken Lamberton who lives down in Arizona who was in jail for a few years, and he talked about having the night taken from him. You know, they're in light all night long. They have to sleep in light. And he said, you know, we're allowing the night to be taken from us, and people are growing up now without the experience of the night sky. One of the most startling statistics I found with the book is that 8 of 10 kids born in the U.S. now will never live where they can see the Milky Way. What used to be the most common human experience, walking out at night and seeing the universe, has been turned into one of the most rare of human experiences. And it is really hard to put it into words what it means, but we can also think about how the view of the stars has inspired astronomy, science, medicine, spirituality, religion, reflection, meditation throughout human history. And to think that we're losing that now and that kids are growing up without that firsthand experience of a night sky is really powerful.
Now, I grew up on an acreage outside of Cedar Falls, and our yard light burned out, and we never got it fixed because none of us liked the yard light anyway. So one of my favorite things as a kid was on those beautiful, clear summer nights, I would lay down outside and I would look at the stars and see the Milky Way. And there was this sensation sometimes of almost leaving the Earth. And I always thought it was just me. But you actually, that's something that a lot of people experience. You write about that sensation in your book, Paul.
Yeah, there's actually a name for it. It's called celestial vaulting. It's that sensation of falling into the sky, which... again, it's breathtaking. I'm guessing that Jack has probably experienced that and at one point or not. And I bet a lot of your listeners, especially unfortunately, maybe the older folks have experienced that feeling of falling into the night sky. It's pretty amazing.
Michael is on the line next from Harper. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I just got to relate this. I was about 6 years old. My dad and I would lay out on the lawn on a summer night, and we'd look up at the sky, and he'd point out all the constellations that as he knew them. And this was before night lights. Mm-hmm. So we were the only light. The night sky was the only light. And anyway, he would say, just think, Mickey, how far that goes. Just think how far it goes. And he says, and when it's done, what is there, a wall? And then if it's a wall, how thick is it? And then on the other side of that wall, what is there? And that gave me the first idea of infinity. And I just thought, I shared that with my own children then. I'm 70 years old. I shared that with my own children about what, oh, my Lord, what an amazing experience it is to watch a night sky. Thank you for your show today.
Yeah, Michael, thank you so much for your call. And we have messages from a lot of people. Here's a tweet from Tony. He says, I love to watch meteor showers in Flagstaff, Arizona. There's a light ordinance in effect there. This is from Manuel. The best night ever for me was sailing across the Indian Ocean when in the Navy. I never knew there were that many stars in the sky. From Don, I used to spend a lot of time in rural central Maine. If the house lights were all off at night and one went outside, it was almost like being inside a planetarium. Complete darkness, except for what light came from the moon. This is from David. The Yellow River State Forest in northeastern Iowa has a great dark sky. The darkest recorded on the Bortle scale is on U.S. 65, just before the Missouri border. And tell me about the scale, Paul. That is a way to measure the darkness of the sky.
Yeah, the Bortle scale is a helpful way to think about how much darkness we have, how much we're losing, that kind of thing. It's a 9-point scale that starts with 9 brightest places like the Las Vegas and the Times Square and works its way down to a level 1, which would be the natural darkness. And the things that stand out to me about this scale, most Americans now live their entire lives in levels 5 and above. They rarely or never experience darkness any better than that. And again, are there any level 1s left in the U.S.? That's a question that's questionable now. Some people would say there really aren't, that you can't go anywhere in the lower 48 and get away entirely from artificial light.
This is an email from Matt in Mason City. The Boundary Waters Canoe Area is strikingly beautiful and possibly even more so at night. And this is a question from Cindy in Ames. Security lighting at Iowa's rural homes, farms, and businesses can be quite awful. And I don't think Iowa counties even have light ordinances. I'm sure that most counties don't. She says, I've experienced rural lights hurting my eyes from a quarter of a mile away. Is there anything we can do about that? And I think a lot of people have had that experience in rural Iowa, Paul.
Yeah, in fact, I remember driving from Minneapolis down to Illinois with my parents, and we used to drive through Iowa, and I would see the quote-unquote security lights out on the horizon in the fields. Those are classic examples of unshielded lights, where the light is not only lighting the property that it's meant to, but it's going for miles and miles and miles. And if folks want that light on their property, that's their choice. But then we need to shield those lights so they're only going down. They're not shining in any other directions. And I would say, too, as we're coming up on the hour here, it is fantastic and invaluable for us to be thinking about how beautiful the night sky is. But we shouldn't think that we're just talking about faraway places, that we're still talking about Iowa. We're still talking about places people can get to, and that we're using too much artificial light at night right now. We can use far less, be just as safe, and bring back some of the beauty of night.
Paul, thank you so much for being here today.
It's been my pleasure.
Paul Bogart is the author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. And Jack, before I let you go, if I was going to go outside with a child to introduce them to the night sky, what do you think the best way is? How do you get kids excited?
Well, there are so many different ways. There's no one way. It's not a one-size-fits-all. I think each individual person has their own personal way of helping young people enjoy the night sky. As a teacher, I tried very hard to not make a one-size-fits-all approach. And I guess that's what I'd have to say.
All right, so get out there and they'll get excited on their own.
I think the night sky will speak for itself.
All right, Jack, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Jack Troger is a retired teacher in Ames, an enthusiastic amateur astronomer, and proprietor of the website darkskyinitiative.org. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, it's Horticulture Day. We'll talk about seeding your lawn. It's getting to be time. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.